This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. At age 32, Jason Reitman has already directed three feature films, all of them exceptionally good. Juno was an Oscar-winning box office hit, and Up in the Air is Reitman's first one with a big star, George Clooney. It's based on Walter Kern's satirical novel about a postmodern business dude who spends his whole life traveling, flying from unglamorous city to unglamorous city, up in the air. The character's major goal in life? Racking up 10 million frequent flyer miles.
It's 10 million miles.
Here he is explaining his dream to a new young colleague out on the road.
Isn't 10 million just a number?
Pie's just a number.
Well, we all need a hobby. No, I don't mean to belittle your collection. I get it. It sounds cool.
I'd be the seventh person to do it. More people have walked on the moon.
Did they throw you a parade?
You get lifetime executive status. You get to meet the chief pilot, Maynard Finch.
Wow.
And they put your name on the side of a plane.
If you guys don't grow up, it's like you need to pee on everything.
Jason Reitman and Walter Kern join me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us.
Up in the Air is about this guy whose job is firing people as a sort of subcontractor. He does this for a living. Walter, you're a novelist and a critic, and you've never really inhabited this kind of corporate world. How did this idea come to you?
Well, my father did inhabit the corporate world. He worked for 3M Corporation in St. Paul, and I used to, as a kid, imagine what he used to call his business trips. That was when air travel was a little more romantic and special, and, you know, leaving on a jet plane was a song on the radio, and I'd think about him going through these sleek, sexy, futuristic environments. Then later in life, when I started to travel a little myself, I met a guy on a plane one day who specified his home as right here, seat 4E, and no real permanent address, lived in hotels, Marriott's, went from consulting job to consulting job, and I thought, I found a new species of human being here and a new jungle in which it lives.
Did you ever talk to him after you published the novel?
No. You know, that's the nature of airports and airplanes. You get a little bit of people's stories. You can't check whether they're true, and then they disappear.
So there's a guy out there somewhere who now George Clooney is playing.
Yeah, that's true.
And he'll probably come forward to claim money.
He'll never hear this because he's never in a car.
Right.
That's right.
Now, the company that Clooney, Ryan, the Clooney character works for, is a company that corporations hire to take care of the firing. Does this exist? Is this real?
Yeah, my wife was actually fired by one of these guys.
Really? Well, how did that happen?
At the time, I think she was my fiance, and she worked in a corporate real estate software company. And yeah, a guy came in, gave her a packet. You know, originally I read the book and I thought it'd be pretty fun to humanize a character who fired people for a living in the same way that I was drawn to the novel Thank You for Smoking, humanizing a tobacco lobbyist. But really, over the course of writing it, and I wrote the screenplay, I adapted the screenplay for 6 years, it evolved into a movie about a man trying to figure out what and who he wanted in his life.
As you were about to start shooting the movie, I presume, was around the time the economy cratered.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect your thoughts about how to do and pitch this film?
Well, it changed in one major way, and that is the scenes in which Ryan was firing people, the ones that I had written, suddenly didn't seem appropriate for this film. They were a little too funny, and they didn't take what was going on seriously enough. And so I came up with the idea of actually using real people who had lost their jobs in the movie.
So those people we see and sort of cut in one after another talking about how they felt after being fired, those are real people who had actually lost their jobs?
27 people get fired in this movie, 22 of which are people who actually just lost their jobs. They're people in Detroit and St. Louis who answered an ad we put out in the local paper saying that we were making a documentary about job loss. We would interview them at a table, ask them questions about what it's like to lose their job in this kind of economy, and then we would actually fire them on camera, telling them to either respond with what they said the day they lost their job or if they preferred what they wish they had said.
How was that as an experience for you, as a human experience, beyond the filmmaking experience?
Rough, emotional, dramatic, eye-opening. because this was so relevant to them and so at the surface, they were able to be in the moment right from the beginning and do this kind of odd improv scene where they would work with our interviewer as if they were doing a scene and ask questions and get emotional, get dramatic, and get angry and cry and say the kinds of things that I would have never written or directed them to do given 10 years to do it.
Now, your father is the director Ivan Reitman, who made Meatballs and the Ghostbusters movies and lots of other big hits. Lots of children of filmmakers who go into the business don't do as well as their parents, become poor man's versions of them. Not in your case at all. Does your father think, oh, good, my son's making better, even better films than I made?
I'm not sure if he thinks that, but I know he's extraordinarily
proud
of me.
Does he hate you for making such good films?
No, are you kidding me? He's as proud a father as I've ever met, and he convinced me to become a filmmaker. When I was 17, I was terrified by the idea of becoming a director.
Having grown up in it.
Well, yeah, for these reasons you're just saying. I mean, we know of many cases of young children of celebrities trying to become directors.
Frank Sinatra Jr.
The presumption is generally the same. They're usually a talentless, spoiled brat with an alcohol or drug problem. And I thought, why enter a business where this is the presumption? And my father at 17 took me aside. I was pre-med at the time. I thought I was going to be a doctor. I thought, I'm going to pick a job that no one will ever question. And he convinced me to be a storyteller. He said, that's what's in your heart, and you have to follow your heart. And he became the first Jewish father on record to tell his son, don't be a doctor, become a filmmaker.
Walter, is making movies more fun than writing novels?
It appears to be from the outside. First of all, there's better food.
You don't have craft services at home?
No bowls of M&Ms. It looks a lot less lonely. You know, this book, which is about a guy who's moving through airports and crowds and so on, was actually written in a tiny snowbound cabin in Montana. And it was, first of all, to me, a book about loneliness, but about the way that loneliness can be exhilarating because it leaves possibilities open. And that without ever having that conversation with Jason, that became one of his themes, teaches me that art can exist in several forms, communicating its message, sort of like, you know, the worm becomes the butterfly. And I think this adaptation is a beautiful example of that. Its essence is preserved, but its shape is transformed.
And you also have a non-speaking role as just some middle-aged dude at a meeting.
Yeah, that was a worst-case scenario for me in which I had to sit next to George Clooney providing an objective comparison between our faces for my own girlfriend. I'd never want to appear on screen again.
Jason, how come you let, I mean, a writer, not even the screenwriter, but the novel writer, hang around the set? That's not done.
I want to have a good relationship with the writers that I work with. I've never wanted to wind up in a situation like Stanley Kubrick and Stephen King on The Shining, where they really were at each other's throats.
So they're not schmucks with Underwoods to you,
famous saying goes. It's quite the opposite. They make me look good. And one can only be a good adapter if you're working with great words. So it's only in my best interest that I stay close and that I bring them into the process.
So what drew you to the initial novel was the idea of portraying this alienated guy who didn't know he was alienated, and was that the germ that began?
No, and I still actually don't think of him as an alienated guy. I oddly identify with him. I'm someone myself who loves traveling and loves being surrounded by strangers. I find that some of my favorite conversations are with people I don't know. You can oddly say things to strangers on planes that you couldn't say to anyone else you knew well.
I think everyone on a plane ride feels for about half an hour like they could, when they land, start a new life, kick an old habit, find a new love, and so on.
Well, you guys both have more of a glamorous idea of air travel than I certainly do. You mentioned the Thank You for Smoking guy, this lobbyist for the tobacco industry. But even beyond him and beyond this character, in Juno, here's a character in a different way who does this very un-PC thing of smart girl decides not to have an abortion and have this baby. There's a theme there, yeah?
I like tricky characters.
But tricky in this specific way.
I like being somewhat contrarian and humanizing them and taking a different look. I started thinking of the character of Ryan as someone who was initially dead set in the idea of being alone, but now was being confronted by these spectacular women who were pushing him to think otherwise. And then, of course, it was unusual that we found a movie star to play that character who seems to be going through the same thing in his own life.
What happened to Alex?
She had to leave town early to get to a meeting.
It's too bad. Where's she live?
Chicago.
You thinking of going to see her?
I don't really have that kind of relationship. Try right over there. That's right.
What kind of relationship do you have?
You know, casual.
Sounds pretty special.
It works for us.
Don't you think there's a future there?
I never really thought about it. What's going on here?
Really never thought about it?
No.
How can you not think about that? How does it not even cross your mind that you might want a future with someone?
It's simple. You know that moment when you look into somebody's eyes and you can feel them staring into your soul and the whole world goes quiet just for a second?
Yes.
Right, well, I don't.
I remember when George Clooney read the script for the first time, he said to me, and this is kind of our first and final conversation on the matter, he said, I know how people are going to connect my persona to this character, and I'm ready to stare it straight in the eyes. And that he did. Someone recently said to me, and I thought this was quite accurate, that the book is about a man who is losing it, and the movie is about a man who is finding it.
I told Jason last night that it's a Rorschach book, this movie. Every time I see it, and I go to see it, every chance I get, every screening I get, I see a different movie. Sometimes I see a great Billy Wilder Hollywood comedy full of banter. Sometimes I see something like a sort of social, critical, realistic appreciation of our lot from the 1940s. And sometimes I see a sort of beautiful, sweeping, melancholy hymn to America at this moment.
Well, I want to thank you both, Jason Reitman and Walter Kern, for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Up in the Air director Jason Reitman, along with his co-screenwriter Sheldon Turner, as well as the actors George Clooney, Vera Farmiga, and Anna Kendrick, are all nominated for Academy Awards.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye.
And that is it for this week. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast of Studio 360 for free at our website, studio360.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Studio360Show.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like...